Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Charles Lane, and he will be speaking on The West, Striking the Rock. So let's listen in on Charles Lane.
First, a note or two about what prompted all this in the first place. Quite a crowd here this evening. Can I have a show of hands, those who are here for the very first of these this week? Oh, good. I can tell a lot of the same stories and not bore too many people in that case. Those of you who listened to this a couple times, bear with me for a second, because I kind of want to set the stage with this. The thing that prompted this particular session on my part occurred about a month ago as I was flying from San Francisco back to Dallas, and I picked up the San Francisco newspaper, and it turned to the editorial page. Other people turned to the sports page, other people turned to the stock market reports first. I always turned to the editorial page first, figuring that's about the most entertainment I'm liable to get out of the newspaper. So turned to the editorial page, and there I found an editorial about our Secretary of the Interior, Bruce Babbitt, and the fact that he was contemplating, as Secretary of the Interior, expanding those fledgling efforts that are now underway at the South Rim of the Grand Canyon and in Yosemite to restrict vehicular traffic in the national parks. In other words, to make everybody park outside the park area, right at the entrance to the park area, and take public transportation in order to cut down on all of that confusion that goes on in there. And if you've been in Yosemite in recent years, you've seen some of that. And the author of the editorial, and I as well, sitting there reading this, you know, had this immediate flash that now 25 years after he wrote the book, and a couple years now since he's passed away, Edward Abbey has become the prophet of the day. And Edward Abbey, in 1968, spent actually one of several summers in Arches National Monument, which it was at the time, and wrote this seminal work, Desert Solitaire. And in it, in 1968, he called for exactly the thing that Bruce Babbitt is just now getting around to. If you've never read Abbey, he is somebody that I recommend to you, particularly for his nonfiction, more so than his fiction. I like his fiction too, but his nonfiction with respect to his observations of the American West are well worth reading. He is very rough around the edges. Don't read him with a faint heart by any means. But this work right here is a stunning piece of work. The third chapter or so is actually entitled A Polemic, Diatribe Against, in other words, the national park system and industrial tourism. And in that chapter, he spells out a lot of things that he thought at that time should have been done to help the national parks and that we're just now coming around to. So all of that got me started thinking a little bit about the nature of the American West. And I suspect in some respects I'm going to be preaching to the choir here this evening. Most of you are here because you enjoy the setting of Holden and you enjoy getting away here in the North Cascades. But I wanted to tackle a couple of different things this evening. Leading up, and if you can be here tomorrow morning, I have a session at 10:30 entitled Rocky Mountain Divide, and it's something a little different. The story of public land trusts on a much smaller scale than the Nature Conservancy, where they are and how you can get involved in them in terms of preserving, private land trusts, in terms of preserving private lands in the United States and especially in the part of the world in which you live. So as a prelude to that this evening, I was going to tackle a little bit of a history of conservation in the American West, and I was going to introduce those of you who don't know to a little bit of Wallace Stegner. Show of hands, people who've never heard the name before. Okay, this will work. I can act like I know what I'm doing here as well. Wallace Stegner passed away, a couple years ago? About 2 years ago. Writer in residence at Stanford for many, many years. He was 85, 86, 87, something like that. Writer in residence at Stanford for many, many years, and an observer of the West, a chronicler of the West. He actually wrote very early on in his career a book entitled The Big Rock Candy Mountain. That ring any bells?
Yeah.
That old hobo song, right? Here's a collection of his essays entitled Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs. Okay. Off of that song as well. And Wallace Stegner put together an essay a number of years ago entitled Striking the Rock. And what I want to do is just read you the opening passage out of here as kind of a prelude to this whole thing, because I think there's some fruitful things we can chase around here a little bit this evening. Wallace Stegner, as a literary type, had several responsibilities during his life to editorial boards, and actually acted as editor for different kinds of magazines during his long life. And as such, he received manuscripts from people that wanted to be published. He received visits from people that wanted to be published. This is his story of a meeting with a, he didn't give the name, but a rather famous architect who was wanting to publish his autobiography and approached Stegner about the possibility of doing this. So Stegner and his wife had this fellow in one evening, and the fellow started showing them some slides of what he'd done and talking with him. This is Stegner's recollection of that. One night he, the architect, showed us slides of some of his houses, including a $1 million palace in the California desert, of which he was very proud. He said it demonstrated that with imagination, technical know-how, modern materials, and enough money, an architect could build anywhere without constraints, imposing his design vision on any site in any climate. In the waterless, pale desert, spotted with shad scale and creosote bush, and backed by barren, lion-colored mountains, another sort of architect, say Frank Lloyd Wright, might have designed something contextural, something low, broad-eaved, thick-walled, something that would mitigate the hot light, something half-underground so that people could retire like the lizards and rattlesnakes from the intolerable daytime temperatures, something made of native stone or adobe or tamped earth in the colors and shapes of the country, something no more visually intrusive than an outcrop. Not our architect. He had built of cinder block in the form of cubes, the only right angles in the desert. He had painted them a dazzling white. Instead of softening the lines between building and site, he had accentuated them, surrounding his sugary cubes with acres of lawns and a tropical oasis of oleanders, hibiscus, and palms. Not the native Washingtonia palms either, which are a little scraggly, but sugar and royal palms with a classier, more Santa Barbara look. Water for this estancia, enough water to have sustained a whole tribe of desert Indians, he had brought by private pipeline from the mountains, literally miles away. The patio around the pool, who would live in the desert without a pool, would have fried the feet of swimmers 300 days out of the year, and so he had designed canopies that could be extended and retracted by push button, and under the patio's concrete he had laid pipes through which cool water circulated by day. By night, after the desert chill came on, the circulating water was heated, he had created an artificial climate inside and out. Studying that luxurious, ingenious, beautiful, sterile incongruity, I told its creator, who sincerely, that I thought he could build a comfortable house in hell. That pleased him. He thought so too. What I didn't tell him, what he would not have understood, was that we thought his desert house immoral. It exceeded limits. It offended our sense not of the possible, but of the desirable. There was no economic or social reason for anyone's living on a barren flat, however beautiful, where every form of life sought shelter during the unbearable daylight hours. The only reasons for building there were to let mad dogs and rich men go out in the midday sun, and to let them own and dominate a view they admired. The house didn't fit the country, it challenged it. It asserted America's never-say spirit and America's ingenious know-how. It seemed to us an act of arrogance on part of both owner and architect. The desert house seemed to me, and still seems to me, a paradigm. Hardly a paradigm, more a caricature of what we have been doing to the West in my lifetime. Instead of adapting, as we began to do, we we've tried to make country and climate over to fit our existing habits and desires. Instead of listening to the silence, we've shouted into the void. We've tried to make the arid West into what it was never meant to be and cannot remain, the garden of the world and the home of multiple millions. Wallace Stegner. So if you think you've liked any of that.
When was that written?
Let's see if I can give you a date on that one. It doesn't give a date. This is written over a very long lifetime. This book is a 1992 compilation, but his books have been published over a great many years. I don't see any of his shorter pieces in here, but he has things going back as far as 1937. So here's Wallace Stegner, and if you like that, why, I heartily recommend him to you. He is not in the library or in the bookstore this year that I've noticed, but I have seen him there before. Okay, so, got that?
Yes.
Wallace Stegner. Okay. He defined the American West for us just a moment ago in that little piece of work I just read. Did you catch how he defined it? What is it that, as far as Stegner is concerned, defines the American West?
Aridity.
Aridity. The arid nature. The, what is it, Leibniz's law of the minimum? The limiting factor of a system controls the entire system. Aridity is how he defines the American West. And he and geographers tend to define the American West on the basis of what's called the 20-inch isohyetal line. How about isohyetal line? That doesn't do anything for you. Anybody else, Chuck?
Probably rainfall.
Rainfall line. The 20-inch rainfall line. For him, defines the American West. Once you go under 10 inches, most geographers will talk about that area being a desert. But once you go under 20 inches, they'll define an area as arid. If you do that, where does that put the start of the American West as you head back east across the country?
Rocky.
Yeah. Even, all right, let's where do we? Who are our Midwestern Scandahoovians tonight? We have a few. Any of you Dakotans? Used to be. You gave it up. Sure, that 20-inch isohyetal actually starts almost midway through the Dakotas. So it starts over here midway in the Dakotas and runs north, south, all the way through western Nebraska. When you're out in Scotts Bluff and Chadron, that part of the world would be considered part of the arid West. By that definition, I, born and raised on the plains of far western Kansas, where we had about 12 inches of rain a year, would be a westerner. And then cutting across the Oklahoma Panhandle, and then sort of obliquely across southwest Texas. My current place of residence, Abilene, Texas, which everybody would think of as the dry portion of West Texas and part of the Romantic West, actually has 24 inches of rain a year. And not by definition part of the West as geographers would define it. So that would be Stegner's and a great many other people's definition of the West. And of course, the Pacific littoral, which we're verging on now, then kind of takes parts of this country out of the picture as well. What is it in Vancouver?
It's about 30.
About 30 inches. And then increasing, of course, back up the coast toward Portland and Seattle. So with the exception of the Pacific littoral, everything from that part of what many of us think of the Midwest all the way to the coast would be defined as the American West.
Rest of the Cascades.
Rest of the Cascades.
Some isolated pockets.
My next place of residence will be the Rogue Valley of South Central Oregon, and it's characterized by only 20 inches of rainfall.
I was thinking of Squim, it's about 12. Mm-hmm.
green shadow behind you.
And if, once you get far enough, that Pacific littoral tends to taper off. When I lived in Southern California outside of Los Angeles, I was again looking at only about 12, 14 inches of rain a year. So Stegner and others would define the West on the basis of its aridity. And therein, by taking the process one step further, would tell us that there are things that you cannot do in the West that you can do in other parts of the country. And ecologists talk about climax communities, the things that naturally grow in an area, and if you clear them out in certain parts of the world, such as the American West, you don't tend to get a return to that climax community. You get to a step down, comes back in there. And Stegner would argue that the practices, the agricultural practices of the East and upper Midwest were never successfully taken to the West because they didn't understand that particular principle, that the recovery you could get from agricultural practices in the East, if you needed to get back to or wanted to get back to the original climax community, it's very difficult to accomplish in the West, so you couldn't treat it in the same way. Stegner would then argue that the history of conservation in this country is basically a Western phenomenon. Okay, that's where I'd like to start. Anything you want to throw at, well, of course, throw in anything anytime. I'm waiting for Bill here. He usually has all kinds of things to say to me. But throw in anything at any time. But what I'm going to do next is kind of take you through a short history of conservation in this country, which many people would argue is a Western phenomenon, even though it now is applied clear across the country. All right. Nobody has any problems with the philosophical basis for conservation, following a line of descent that would start off with somebody like Emerson and going to Thoreau. I think I spelled that right. I spelled Thoreau right?
Yeah,
that's
right.
And
yes, I have to.
From there, of course, to John Muir. That sort of religious naturalism that started out, obviously, the New England way, but Muir brought to the West with him. Okay. How about this? How about if I bring something like this? And throw out the name George Perkins Marsh. Does that ring any bells?
No. George Perkins Marsh. George Perkins Marsh.
Doesn't particularly ring any bells. Middle 1800s, 1850s, 1860s, George Perkins Marsh actually was quite the Renaissance man, ambassador to Italy for a number of years, kind of roving U.S. ambassador at large for many years, but quite an observer of nature. Had grown up in Vermont, had spent some time in the upper Midwest, especially Michigan, both lower and upper peninsula areas of Michigan. And in addition, his travels around the world had taken him to a great many places where he had the opportunity to study, among other things, the demise of ancient civilizations. And he became very interested in the processes of deforestation, on the one hand, and salinization of the soils by excessive groundwater usage and the decline of the ancient Mesopotamian cultures. He was particularly interested in the deforestation issue because he had grown up in Vermont early in the century, had seen the Vermont forests devastated, and then in the middle part, or starting in the middle part of the 19th century, in the middle part of the 1800s, had seen the logging practices that had cleared Michigan, both lower and upper peninsula. So he's very interested in those things. In 1864, he wrote a book entitled Man and Nature, which was one of the first real scientific looks at what's later to become ecology, human effect upon the environment. Okay. But he also started working on an organization that in the year 1875, I'm going to get kind of chronological here. In 1875, he started, or actually before this, he started a group that in 1875 ended up becoming the American Forestry Association. And the reason that this is kind of crucial is that the American Forestry Association worked very hard and long for a period of about 16 years to do something for the preservation of American forests, so that by the time you got to 1891, as a direct influence of this organization, which Marsh had had a big hand in, 1891 you had the Forest Reserve Act. That's what gave us the national forests. All these national forests that we have out here around us. That's the line of descent that gave us the national forests. So George Perkins Marsh and the American Forestry Association were the group that lobbied Congress, and after 16 years of that effort gave us the National Forest Service. A couple of things happened in here as well. In, of course, 1872, it was Yosemite. Establishment of Yosemite is the first of the national parks. Yesterday we talked a little bit about that. A surprising genesis to that as well. The first person to suggest that Yosemite be a park was a fellow named Israel Raymond, who was a representative of the Central American Steamship Transit Company. And he wanted to bring tourists to San Francisco on a steamship and then ship them over to Yosemite. So there's an element of industrial tourism in the genesis of the national parks to start with.
What year was that? Do you know about what time that was?
The park was established in 72. Raymond worked on that about 1864, 1865.
Okay. So he talked to Lincoln.
I think that he found a bigger booster in Grant, ultimately, than that. But yes, they were the American... Or the
Lincoln was preoccupied with
something. Certain other things going on, yes. Yeah, a few other things on his mind. And, of course, one of the other interesting notes to this is that, of course, the Park Service was not established until 1916. And we found out yesterday that the people that were busy running Yosemite for the first 44 years of its existence were elements of the United States Cavalry.
Where did you ever Pinchot fit in this picture?
Pinchot?
Governor of Pennsylvania.
The wise use conservationist. Actually, Pinchot weaves in and out of a lot of this stuff, as a matter of fact. And had a large part to play, although not in a particularly positive fashion, with the formation of the national parks.
Maybe Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, give me a minute and I'll come to this, because okay. Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt had a large part to play in stopping this, the Forestry Reserve Act in 1907. It did not last very long. Congress, especially from western and northwestern states with logging interests, actually put a bill through Congress to overturn the Forest Reserve Act. And one of the things I don't know for sure is what Roosevelt's thinking was on all this. He had, as the president, the authority to simply veto the bill. But for whatever reason, and I've never really tracked this down, he didn't think the political climate was very good for him to veto the bill, so he signed the bill, but he signed it after he and Pinchot had stayed up all night. And he and Pinchot had gotten out maps of the western United States, and for about a 18 to 20 hour period through the night of the night before he signed the bill, he and Pinchot put away 16 million acres of forest lands under the act, and then he signed the bill that vetoed his that stopped his power to do that. So, yeah, Pinchot is one of the characters, one of the players in all of this stuff. There's actually another sort of interesting happening in here. In 1886, you got the first Audubon Society. The first Audubon Society is formed at that point in time. So the Audubon Society, you may know this, predates the Sierra Club by a fair number of years. Jed, this happened. 1891 was our Forest Reserve Act. By the time you got to 1892, there's John Muir and the Sierra Club. By the time you got to 1894, we had something that is referred to as the Park Protection Act. Right. Park Protection Act. This stopped hunting in parks. It stopped the hunting of game in parks.
Which parks?
The national parks existed, the National Park Service didn't.
Okay.
It's just kind of an odd deal, but that's how it worked. There were actually something like 16 or so, either 13 or 16 national parks in existence at 1916 when the Park Service finally was formed. So yeah, there were a number of national parks here, and we got the Park Protection Act, which is where we got banishment of hunting on park property. So that came up in 1894. By the time we got to 1906, there was something else that came up that is referred to as the Antiquities Act. Antiquities Act. This was actually responsible for the formation of national monuments. So that national monuments actually came in before the national parks as well. Parks were kind of on the tail end of all this stuff. The idea was instigated, or the driving force behind it was that you were getting a whole lot of pot hunting going on in the American Southwest. So things like Chaco Canyon in New Mexico were being picked over, and the government wanted to kind of put a halt to that. So they instituted the Antiquities Act to put in the national monuments. National monuments are now run by the National Park Service. They do not enjoy quite the same status as national parks. There are different types of operations, including such things as mining operations, that can go on in national monuments that you cannot do in national parks. I don't know if you've been following this or not, but there is a bill in Congress as we speak to elevate Death Valley National Monument to national park status. For the preservation of Death Valley. I, for one, agree with it entirely. It's a magnificent place to visit anytime between October and March. Actually, the lower campgrounds, unless you happen to have an RV that you can plug in and turn on your air conditioner, lower campgrounds are basically closed to tent camping, believe it or not, at the end of March. And you wouldn't want to push that. Wouldn't want to do it. So, 1906, the Antiquities Act. In 1907 was, in essence, this negation of the Forest Reserve Act by basically logging interests in the Northern Rockies and the Cascades, where Pinchot and Roosevelt sat around the table and preserved the rest of these federal lands and then signed the legislation that wouldn't let them do it anymore. That rolls in 1907. Next big thing, 1916 rolls in, and this is when we finally get the national parks. Formation of the National Park Service. Yeah. Pinchot actually had a as well. He was opposed to the idea. He thought the national, because the national parks already existed, right? The national parks already existed. He thought that they should just be operated under the Forest Service, right? And so he opposed this. He lost this one. It was not put under the National Forest Service. And again, those of you who were yesterday, I'm sorry to cover some some of the same ground again, but this kind of sets the stage for a number of other things to come up. Pinchot, a few years earlier, in about 12, had gone head-to-head with John Muir over the public's use of the parks without impairment. That's the buzz phrase. Public use without impairment. Pinchot, being very utilitarian and a kind of a wise use forester, focused on the public use part, and of course John Muir would focus on the without impairment part. Okay. Anybody with an idea of some of the landscape at the northern end of Yosemite National Park, up kind of the north side? We don't typically go. You go more toward the south side and into the Yosemite Valley, or you go up to, over to Wall New Meadows and down toward Lee Vining. But do you know what occupies the far north end of Yosemite National Park?
Hetch Hetchy.
Hetch Hetchy.
That was a big fight.
They got into it over Hetch Hetchy. That's the water thing. I took this last time. You want to talk about Hetch Hetchy for a minute? Anybody?
That was a big fight. Muir didn't want that at all, did he?
No. A big fight, which Muir lost. Hetch Hetchy was, still is, part of the city of San Francisco's water supply. And at the time, it was badly needed by the city of San Francisco, that whole San Andreas Lake area that's out there, Daly City Way, now on the peninsula, really was not in place. And so what actually happened was the damming of Hetch Hetchy and the flooding of that valley, the creation of the reservoir for the city of San Francisco. And it was done in a national park. Remember, this park was established in 1872. So this was done in a national park. Public use without impairment. Well, see, the public use without impairment was not really formalized until 16 with the establishment of the Park Service. Muir lost the fight and actually was dead within a year or two after that. He fought that very hard. The reason, and those of you who have ever been to the Yosemite Valley might appreciate this, Muir thought that Hetch Hetchy was every bit as nice, if not more so, than the main valley of Yosemite. So he fought that tooth and nail. He lost. He did not have the without impairment clause to back him up. We'll see how that's worked to the Sierra Club's advantage here in just a minute in later cases. But he lost that. And you can think of this in one of two ways. It was a disastrous loss for Muir because he didn't want it. On the other hand, the fight brought so much national attention to the Sierra Club that it was really about 1912 that the Sierra Club took off and really worked. That's when it got off and got going. Was at that point in time. Okay. All right. How about the name David Brower? That do anything for anybody?
Friends of the Earth.
Among other things.
Sierra.
Sierra Club president for a fairly long time, 40s, 50s, I think, running into the 60s, as a matter of fact. David Brower was the head of the Sierra Club in the 1950s with the Colorado River storage project. Does that ring any bells? Colorado River Storage Projects. Would have been probably early to mid-50s that this was going on. Who's enjoyed a visit to Dinosaur National Monument up in northeastern Utah? Anybody been? Yeah, there's one in the back over there. Pretty nice. The Split Mountain Anticline, the Green River comes through there. Of course, if you've got kids that love dinosaur bones, this is hard to beat. Of course, the only problem with going to Dinosaur National Monument is you got to go there to get there, right? It's not, let's just drive by. You don't drive by this place. You've really got to make an effort to get there, but it's It has great paleontological significance and some spectacular scenery. The Green River is, of course, coming down out of Flaming Gorge up on the Wyoming side through the Uintas and comes through the Split Mountain, where it just cuts right through the mountain, and wonderfully scenic place. The proposal was to dam that and basically bury all of this underneath the lake. The problem for the people that were promoting the construction of the dam and the creation of the reservoir and a water impoundment system in the upper reaches of the Colorado drainage, we consider the Green River part of the Colorado River drainage system. The only problem was this 1916 establishment of the Park Service and the clause of public use without impairment. It was very hard for the people who were proposing to dam up the Green to demonstrate that there was going to be no impairment on the monument. And they lost that one.
Were the monuments part of the Park Service then?
I believe that the monuments got into the administration of the Park Service pretty quickly after the Park Service was formed.
Isn't there a dam across the Flaming Gorge somewhere?
There is a dam across the Flaming Gorge, yes.
When was that put in? 50s?
I think so. Very modest by comparison with what they're trying to do here, though. The Green picks up more water out of the Uintas and really becomes a piece of work. And the idea was to get those upper states, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, a big reservoir. That actually has been a problem for Salt Lake and the whole Utah front since that point in time, and they are still trying to get trans-basin water deliveries, not necessarily from there, but things on the other side of the summit in the Uintas. That's actually something I want to try and cover a little bit tomorrow. But this was a mammoth project proposed, and the Sierra Club got this shot down. David Brower was in charge of that, got the thing shut down on the public use without impairment clause, is how he managed to accomplish that. Let me throw another name at you that should be a little easier to do something with. Let's try Aldo Leopold. What's that do for anybody?
Lake Powell.
What does Aldo do for Lake Powell?
He was, I think, one of the ones that were fighting the... Well, Powell was against it, too.
Well, Powell was actually a very good student of the American West, and he really understood the aridity problem, and he would have changed the Homestead Act regulations that applied to settling the far west on that basis to reduce the total population that moved in and try to cut down on the boosterism that was going on. He was basically shouted down by the boosters that wanted to promote the West. Aldo Leopold, Sand County Almanac. If I mention that name, does that do anything for you? If you've never read a book on conservation or preservation, you should read Sand County Almanac. It literally is the Bible of the conservation movement in this country. Aldo Leopold was a forester and an exquisitely elegant writer, a wonderful observer. Sand County Almanac is actually about central Wisconsin, believe it or not. He taught at the University of Wisconsin and maintained a cabin out in Sand County, out in kind of the sand barrens in central Wisconsin. And it's the story of his observations of the land. But we have much right here in Holden Village, and right now, in 1994, that we owe to Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold started out a very long time ago. Sand County Almanac was published in 1949 posthumously. Leopold died in 1948. But as a young man and a forester, he was stationed with the U.S. Forest Service in Albuquerque and was basically personally responsible for the establishment of the Gila Wilderness area down in far southern New Mexico. That was Aldo Leopold's work that did that. Now, the actual act did not get passed until 1964, But there is a direct line of descent from Aldo Leopold through several other people to the 1964 Wilderness Act.
Next door.
That's right down there where the sign says, please don't take your bicycles any farther. So it's the 1964 establishment of the Wilderness Act that gave us, among other things, Glacier Peak Wilderness Area right here. That's where it came from. And what that act did was enable the designation of wilderness out of actually Park Service land, Monument Service land, National Forest land, even BLM land, really any of the federal lands. It allowed for the establishment of wilderness zones within them where people were just going to visit, not going to have any kind of permanent habitation, but just visit. So we owe a certain debt of gratitude to Aldo Leopold for that, because he kind of got that ball rolling. And Stegner would tell us that was about it. Stegner would tell us that in terms of the conservation of, setting aside preservation, conservation of public lands, that was about it. Stegner would tell us that something happened in 1962 that changed the entire course of the American environmental movement and changed the entire environmental consciousness. 1962, a rather influential book was published that year,
Silent Spring.
Rachel Carson gave us Silent Spring, and that is, I just checked today over in the bookstore, gave us Silent Spring, and we started shifting a focus from conserving and preserving lands to, we have these pollution problems, how do we address them? How do we clean them up? I'm going to try and tackle something tomorrow where maybe Stegner was premature in saying that the preservation of lands is done in this country, because it's not. But there is now a shift toward preservation of private lands and ways that that can actually be done, which is what I want to tackle a little bit tomorrow. But this was the last of the great conservation preservation legislation with respect to public lands, 1964, the Wilderness Act. Okay, Chuck, you ready? We'll jump into one of Chuck's favorite things right now. Stegner and various other people would tell us that this kind of thing, the idea of conservation and preservation, this kind of thing really cannot happen without having a particular perspective. And Chuck and I were talking a little bit about this a couple days ago. And it has to do with something referred to as a sense of place. Stegner, and how many of his books do you have?
A few.
Stegner has long been an advocate of a sense of place, and it being crucially important to community with land, treating land as community with us rather than a commodity to be handled by us. If I put this up here, tell me what the first thing is that tends to come to mind. The wide open
spaces.
Wide open spaces. So, throw a couple things. Space. What does that imply to you?
Wyoming.
That's true. More like a dictionary definition. What is space?
Boyd?
Open.
Open?
Distance.
Distance. We're taking ideas here.
Area.
Distance, area. Any connotation of nothingness?
Vacant.
Vacant.
Undeveloped.
Undeveloped people. All right, so we're rolling now. Unpeopled.
How about freedom?
So that does force. Okay. I mean, I've had enough. If you got some more here, why throw them out? That works for me for a while. What happens when you change that to wide open places? How does that shift your thinking about wide open places?
Pretty limited the space, the places.
Connotation more towards surroundings.
Yeah.
Places have content.
Places have content. The places have content. This is, space is sort of contentless.
And places somewhere I can go.
Places somewhere you can go.
Holden is a place.
Holden is a place. Sure, sure. I hang out with land use planners from time to time. They are really a harried, hurried, abused, and thoroughly misunderstood bunch of people. And actually, I feel more sorry for them than anything else. Now, having said that, do we have any land use planners? Okay, I'm going to tell you another land use planning story here in a bit. But
great, I'd love to hear it.
But
is that another euphemism for real estate developers?
No, actually, I don't think so. And you may not have wished to have admitted to that, but a legitimate question to ask one is, what good is land use planning? You know, what are you trying to accomplish with that? Even in the vernacular of land use planners, we tend to talk about wide open spaces, or we talk about space utilization. Okay, open space plans, you know, this kind of thing. But think how that changes around a little bit if we talk about place. Open place planning. I mean, there's a different feel to that, a different sort of connotation. The story I was going to tell you is that there's the occasional planner that you bump into that has made this sort of mental switch from space to place, and one of them described herself as a recovered planner. by making that. One of Stegner's contemporaries, still living, as a matter of fact, is Wendell Berry. And you'll see there's a raft of his books over here in the bookstore, and I highly recommend him as well. But Wendell Berry picked up on Emerson, who long time ago said, "Who are we?" and then followed up immediately by saying, or asking the question, "Where are we?" And Wendell Berry and Wallace Stegner and a host of these other people will say that it's absolutely impossible for us to know who we are unless we know precisely where we are. That we cannot know ourselves unless we know where we are. And this is the deal, a sense of place. A place is something named too, right? A place is something named. If I say I'm off to the wide open spaces of central Nevada, that's one thing. But if I'm off to visit the Railroad Valley, there is a place. It's named, it's a place. It's a certain kind of place. But you sort of get away from this concept of wide open spaces, this void, this emptiness, this area that is contentless.
that then becomes something to do something with. If you start thinking in terms of place, and that kind of changes the thinking around a little bit. Stegner would argue that the people who fought so long and so hard in the conservation movement, which he would also argue is fundamentally a Western phenomenon, a phenomenon of the Western United States, which has been exported in all kinds of other settings, this fought by people who made that jump, who made the jump from thinking about space, which they're, depending on if you want to look at it that way, there's a lot of it, or was a lot of it in the American West, to the concept of thinking about place in the American West. Comments on all this? Any food for thought? Anything that you think I said is stupid? I must be doing all right because Bill always tells me if I've done something stupid. And he hasn't had a whole lot to say this evening.
Soaking in it.
There's a couple of things here. I'm going to do this to kind of set myself up in some respects for tomorrow, too. But in another Stegner essay, which actually is where a lot of this information is, I like Stegner because he goes through this, so I didn't have to go researching all over the place for it, but he's talking with Chief Luther Standing Bear of the Ogallala Sioux. Stegner's not talking to him, but getting the message from Luther Standing Bear. When he said, only to the white man was nature a wilderness, and only to him was the land infested with wild animals and savage people. To us it was tame, earth was bountiful, and we were surrounded with the blessings of the great mystery. Contrast that with these words from John Widstoe, Witsoe, one of the leaders of the early Mormon church in the settlement of Utah. The destiny of man is to possess the whole earth. The destiny of the earth is to be subject to man. There can be no full conquest of the earth and no real satisfaction to humanity if large portions of the earth remain beyond his highest control. How about that from different perspectives on things? I'm going to come back to that topic a little bit tomorrow because the issue of private land trusts and the preservation of private lands and how people can get involved in doing that is addressed in substantial part. Ready to write down another one? Is addressed in substantial part in a book that is absolutely brand new. The gentleman's name is John Wright. You like this. The man was a land use planner for 20 years.
He wised up,
got his PhD in geography, now is a professor at New Mexico State University, but his book is entitled Rocky Mountain Divide, The Selling and Saving of the West, and he addresses what we can do now if conservation, land use, or land conservation, land preservation issues of interest is. This actually is more than just a philosophical treatise. This is actually like a Betty Crocker's cookbook. This actually will take you through things that can be done. But he compares and contrasts Colorado and Utah in this. And in some respects, the differences between those two states is, you know, they're light years apart. They're right next door to each other. But that's actually the topic that I'm going to try and tackle. I think I've got a 10:30 tomorrow morning, if you care for that. What else? I've just about wrapped everything up I intended to say.
What about the water usage in the West? I mean, that's really there's a lot of pressure put on.
Boy, what a time to ask that question.
All right. Let me read you one other thing. Did you ever read Cadillac Desert?
No.
Cadillac Desert is by a fellow named Mark Reisner.
There was, you know, there was some conservation when they divided up the Colorado River. They looked at what the flow was, and it turned out that it was the most high flow that they've ever had in thousands of years.
Yes, it was. It was absolutely the worst time possible to do that particular thing. So it's 100% used. It's 125 or 130% subscribed. At its headwaters, it's got a salinity of 200 parts per million, which easily meets drinking water standards for salinity. By the time it reaches Yuma, Arizona, it's got 6,300 parts per million total chlorides. You wouldn't really want your cow to drink that. And you couldn't, which is why we've got this desalinization plant down there to try and help out any water that we would send down to Mexico. And of course, Colorado doesn't even enter the Gulf anymore. Here's a quote from a guy by the name of Kasman. This is actually a number of years ago, late 40s, a hydrologist talking about the proposal to build dams up and down the Colorado. Quote, "The reservoir construction program, objectively considered, is really a program for the continued and endless expenditure of ever-increasing sums of public money to combat the effects of geologic forces. As these forces strive to reach positions of relative equilibrium in the region of rivers and the flow of water, it may be that future research in the field of modern hydrology will be primarily to find a method of extracting ourselves from this unequal struggle with a minimum loss to the nation." And he wrote that in 46. Yeah, actually, I could probably spend a whole week's worth of lectures. I mean, because water resources are—that's actually my principal interest. That's actually my principal professional interest.
It kind of takes care of itself, because if they use that water to irrigate, and the soil becomes salinated, and they can't grow anything in it, they ain't going to need the water anymore.
The unfortunate fact of the matter is that historically, every major civilization that has arisen from irrigation in arid lands basically has fallen as a result of salinization of soils.
And back in Minnesota, they're pumping the water out to irrigate the fields. The water table is dropping. They have to water more now.
Man, it's too bad you started at 7:14 or so on that, because we could go on and on. The Burrs that are down here doing the step family thing this last week. He's a southern Idahoan. Grew up at Twin Falls. He used to go down to the river, down to the Snake, to a spot that was called the Thousand Springs, because the groundwater was flowing out of the sides and tumbling down into the Snake. And now it's known as the Land of 100 Trickles, because of the groundwater reduction. I grew up in Ogallala country. If you want to see two fairly substantial American cities with their backs against the wall, I mean, even as we speak today, watch the newspaper to see what Amarillo and Lubbock, Texas are up to. Because their backs are against the wall and turning to surface water.
For water supply?
Yeah. Big cities with big problems. Where are our Seattleites? Who's this? Our, what, fourth, fifth year now of drought conditions in the Pacific Northwest? These things have been forestalled, but there's nothing that will keep them from coming back. You understand that people in Phoenix can't envision that. I mean, they can still read the newspaper, but they can't envision that. They're in desperate shape for water, and the mega engineering projects that are proposed to dam up all of the cascades on the east side and all the way up into British Columbia. I've heard proposals from bringing water from Alaska to southern California and Arizona.